Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Comment ma fille et moi pouvons-nous définir qui peut lui envoyer des messages? Comment parler avec mon fils des bons comportements à adopter en ligne? Si vous avez des questions sur la sécurité de vos ados en ligne, vous trouverez des ressources utiles dans le Centre Familial Instagram. Le Centre Familial vous permet de paramétrer la supervision parentale avec votre ado. Et dans l'espace éducation, vous trouverez des conseils d'experts pour discuter de sécurité. Découvrez nos outils pour la famille sur instagram.com/outils-pour-la-famille.
Sport, but not as you know it. Yes, you're good enough. We wish we could take you, but you're a girl.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service.
The rules were holding her back, so she would have to rewrite them.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Sunday, the 19th of November. The Hamas-run health authorities in Gaza say 80 people have been killed in two airstrikes on the Jabalia refugee camp. In a rally in Jerusalem, thousands of Israelis have called on the government to focus more on freeing the hostages. And tens of thousands of people in Spain have protested against the amnesty deal for Catalan separatists. Also in the podcast...
3, 2, 1...
Elon Musk hails the latest test launch of his giant Starship rocket as a success, even though it ends in an explosion. And should you text before calling? When Israel began its attacks on Gaza following the massacre of 1,200 people by Hamas, an Israeli military spokesman said the emphasis is on damage, not on accuracy. According to Hamas health officials, 12,300 people have now been killed in the Palestinian territory. The ferocity of the Israeli assault has worried some of the relatives of the more than 200 hostages being held in Gaza. And those families have been pushing the Israeli government to do more to prioritise the captives. On Saturday, thousands gathered outside the residence of the Prime Minister in Jerusalem after a five-day march from Tel Aviv.
Still have hope, but each day they're there, it's a danger for them, for their life and for their soul. So we really, really need them home now.
Our government isn't talking to them, isn't telling them what's going on, what are the offers, what are the reasons for and against. Nothing. Nobody's talking to them.
Today is my husband's birthday, and his mother, Yafa Adar, is kidnapped. She's 85 years old. We don't have time. We don't have 1 hour more.
We cannot wait any longer, so we are demand from them to do that now, to pay any price to bring the hostages back.
Well, we'll hear more about the march in a moment, but in Gaza itself, Israel has been accused of killing more than 80 people in twin strikes on the Jabalia refugee camp in the north of the Strip. A Hamas health official said most of the victims had died in a UN school being used as a shelter. Israeli Defence Forces spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner said they were investigating what happened.
I can't confirm this incident is an IDF, but we are seeing the images like you've seen the images on social media, and we are looking into it. I can't confirm at this stage that this is IDF, but we are looking into it.
Palestinian medical staff also said Israeli airstrikes on residential blocks in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza had killed at least 32 people. Israel has been telling people in the south to evacuate again after they were told to move there from the north. On Saturday, many of the patients, medical staff and displaced people sheltering at Gaza's biggest hospital, Al-Shifa, left on foot, saying they'd been given an ultimatum by the Israelis, something Israel denied. The Palestinian Authority health minister in the West Bank is Mai Al-Kaila.
The occupation army this morning had demanded the evacuation of the hospital, of patients, the injured and medical staff, as well as those seeking shelter in the hospital, within 1 hour. Meaning, within 1 hour, they should evacuate to face their unknown fate. They were evicted at gunpoint, and those who remained are 126 patients, 5 doctors and 34 premature babies.
The situation at the Al-Shifa hospital in northern Gaza, according to the Palestinian Authority health minister. The BBC has been trying to verify footage of the apparent attacks on the Jabalia refugee camp, also in northern Gaza, as I heard from our correspondent Nick Beek in Jerusalem.
But it's certainly horrifying footage that is emerging from Jabalia today. Horrifying, in fact, is the word that the head of the United Nations Palestinian Refugee Agency has been using to describe this. We've been looking at some of the footage and it is extremely bleak. Basically, you see a man who's narrating a video and he is walking from classroom to classroom within this United Nations-run school. And it is a scene of carnage, of devastation. There are bodies, people who are severely injured. At one point, there's a young child who looks bewildered, startled, looking at the camera. Also within this, you see that there is a lot of damage to one wall. There's a huge hole in the wall, but the structure itself appears to be intact. This video, and colleagues at the BBC have been looking at this today, the video, it seems, was taken today. The weather in the video matches the conditions on the ground in Jabalia this morning, and also the structure in the video matches previous photographs of the United Nations school. What we can't say is what caused this. Certainly there have been accusations that this is an Israeli strike. The Israelis have been saying, and also a military spokesperson told the BBC today, that they're aware of the video and they are looking into this. They're investigating.
Yeah, of course, Israel says it has been targeting Hamas in the north, Jabalia in the north of the strip, as is Al-Shifa Hospital, and the Israelis say they've been telling people to leave those areas, head to the south. But now we're also hearing about Israeli attacks in the south on residential blocks in Khan Yunis, according to the Palestinians.
That's right. Medics there say that at least 32 people were killed in a strike on a residential block, as you say, or actually residential blocks, a couple of buildings at least. This is significant because the Israelis, as you say, previously cited Khan Yunis, the biggest city in the south, as being a place of safety that people from the north should move to. But what we're seeing now is people have been told to get out by 4 o'clock local time. So that is long past that deadline, some 4 hours ago. There has been the dropping of leaflets, which have been instructing people to move to safety. 4 specific locations have been given, as well as other sort of shelters. And so once again, people who've been told to move, to leave their homes, they've moved to a place of safety, and once again they're being told to move again. Israel says that's because they'll be out of harm's way as they continue to intensify their operations against Hamas. Israel says it's targeting Hamas and it's doing all it can to keep down the number of civilians who've been injured, who've been killed.
Nick Beek in Jerusalem. Well, also in Jerusalem for us is the BBC's Yogita Lamai, and she's been speaking to some of the families who took part in that rally I mentioned earlier. I asked her what the relatives of the hostages thought of the Israeli military operation in Gaza.
Their view is that what needs to be prioritized at the moment is the return of the hostages. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in an interview a couple of days ago, said that their top priorities are first the destruction of Hamas, then the release of hostages. I was speaking to Eli David, who is the brother of 22-year-old Evita David, who was taken hostage from a music festival held in southern Israel. According to him, whatever deal needs to be negotiated for the safe return of the hostages, that needs to happen first, and then everything else can happen after that.
Yeah, I mean, is there any chance of the government listening to those calls to pay any price to get the hostages back, given that that would be likely to involve a ceasefire, which they don't want to do?
The families of the hostages are meeting with some members of the Israeli war cabinet today. What they were saying to me is that, you know, they've had very little information from them so far. They're looking for some answers. One of them said, we're waiting for our leaders to look us in the eye and explain to us what exactly is being done. And of course, you know, it's 6 weeks since these people were taken hostage. There are around 30 children. There are lots of elderly people who require medication every single day. I met with the son of one woman who's 84 years old, who said his mother requires medicines, for a heart ailment. She requires other medicines to keep her going, and he's worried about what kind of condition she's going to be in. So patients running out, they're getting increasingly frustrated. They're saying, you know, leaders aren't meeting them enough.
Yogita Lamai in Jerusalem. Other news now. With about 170,000 people taking part, the demonstration in the Spanish capital Madrid on Saturday was the biggest so far over the decision by the Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, to grant amnesties to Catalan separatists. Mr. Sanchez needed the support of pro-independence parties to secure another term in office. Protesters say it was unconstitutional. Guy Hedgeco reports from Madrid.
Protesters, many waving the red and yellow Spanish flag and the blue and gold European one, gathered in one of Madrid's most famous squares, Plaza de Cibeles. They said Pedro Sánchez's amnesty was unconstitutional, undermined the rule of law and threatened national unity. The amnesty will benefit more than 300 Catalan nationalists who face criminal charges for separatist activity. The demonstration was organised by civic groups. Opposition politicians who are calling for new elections were there as well. The leader of the Conservative People's Party, Alberto Núñez Feijóo, said the alarm bells of Spanish democracy were ringing. Ana Grau is a member of the Catalan Parliament for Ciudadanos, which supports a united Spain.
We are protesting not an agreement, but an abandonment. We have been betrayed by our government.
Mr. Sanchez says the amnesty will reduce political tensions in Catalonia. This was the biggest of recent protests against it, but almost certainly not the last.
Guy Hedgeco in Madrid. Argentinians go to the polls on Sunday in the final round of what's turned out to be an election of surprises. The runoff is a straight head-to-head between contrasting characters. The current economy minister, Sergio Massa, and a former pundit and political outsider, Javier Milei. The vote comes at a particularly difficult time for Argentinians, as our South America correspondent Katie Watson now reports.
In Buenos Aires, Evita still looms large. Her image towers over one of the city's biggest streets, and her name is echoed everywhere. The country's most famous politician and the original champion of the poor is missed by many, especially in these days of economic hardship. The two remaining candidates are promising the world when it comes to improving an economy on its knees. But in Isla Maciel, one of Buenos Aires' poorest neighbourhoods that sits in the shadow of the country's largest port, it's hard to muster enthusiasm for what feels like endless broken promises.
3050.
Lourdes Monjes runs a corner shop with her daughters. She says soaring inflation means paying for the basics is an increasing struggle for her customers. With annual inflation now above 140%, money becomes worthless quickly, and people here want change.
We can't make ends meet. We can't get to the end of the month. I personally have a little notebook of people who can't make ends meet, and I give them items on credit. They can never pay it back because they pay me back and then they end up owing again. So it's a vicious cycle.
¿Vas a dolarizar o no la economía?
Sí, vamos a dolarizar la economía. Vamos a...
The candidates know this all too well. The economy is the number one thing that everyone wants fixing, and the Argentinians have a choice. Leftist Sergio Massa, the current economy minister and part of the political establishment, or radical Javier Milei, a total outsider who's proposed drastic changes like blowing up the central bank or introducing the dollar.
La ruptura del Mercosur.
The two candidates couldn't be further apart politically, as they showed in their final debate.
Ask yourself if you prefer inflation over stability. If you want to continue supporting this corrupt, parasitic and useless political caste that just destroys our wealth generation and sinks us deeper and deeper.
But Javier Milei's proposals, which also include more liberal gun laws and banning abortion, make many people nervous. And that's something Sergio Massa is trying to use to his advantage.
I know there are some who are voting for me not because they are convinced, but just as a way to avoid choosing a path of violence, hatred and harm. And I want to tell all of them that I will ensure they feel that they didn't throw away their vote, but that they trusted someone.
I don't agree that Milei is...
The political style of Javier Milei has captured attention. He's been likened to Donald Trump, and closer to home, Brazil's former leader, Jair Bolsonaro. Back at the port, there's a group of young teenagers kicking around a ball in the street. In the distance are stacks of shipping containers. Several of the teenagers are wearing T-shirts with the name of the country's most famous footballer, Messi. With such little faith that politicians will change anything for the average Argentinian, it feels safer to back sporting heroes instead.
Our South America correspondent, Katie Watson. The second-hand book kiosks that line the banks of the River Seine are a Paris institution, but plans to move the stalls ahead of the opening ceremony of the Olympics next year have caused anger. The authorities in the French capital say the kiosks must be taken down as a security measure. Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, has the details.
The Seine, it was once famously said, is the only river in the world that runs between two bookshelves. Browsing the stalls on its banks has been a pleasure for Parisians and tourists alike since the 19th century. But the river is to be the set for a strikingly innovative Olympics opening ceremony, with thousands of athletes processing in boats past the crowds. The authorities fear the dark green book kiosks could be used to stage a bomb attack. Four kiosks were hoisted up by crane and moved before being reinstated in a trial run yesterday. Michel Boutard from the Cultural Association of Booksellers of Paris likened it to extracting a tooth. It was, he said, something even Nazi occupation had failed to do.
The floods of 1910, the occupation, even Napoleon III didn't manage to do what the Olympic Games may succeed in doing. In other words, make us disappear. And that's it.
The booksellers fear damage to their livelihoods. They're appealing to President Macron to halt what they call a stupid and unnecessary plan.
Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
If we raise $100,000, that will be $10 million of medical debt that is cancelled out.
How a young mother in New York City who died of cancer has helped pay off millions of dollars of other patients' medical debts.
Picture the scene. You're 12 years old, a talented ice hockey player, but despite your skill on the rink, you're not allowed to compete at the highest level of the sport. The reason? You're a girl. Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells the story of Justine Blaney, the girl who fought to change the rules around mixed-sex ice hockey teams in Ontario, Canada. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Space news now, and Elon Musk's huge new rocket Starship has left the launch pad for a second time.
3, 2, 1.
The first test launch ended after 4 minutes when the rocket blew up. Was this one any more successful? I asked our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
I think they will class it as a success. It got further and it got higher than it did last time. If you go back to April when they did this debut flight, I mean, it was drama from the off. There were engines that were shutting down. It ended up doing a loop-the-loop in the sky and tearing itself apart. This time, it looked like a normal launch. You know, it got off the ground. All the engines were firing in unison. It got to this key phase, which they call stage separation. So in rocketry, what happens is you use a big booster on the bottom that gets you off the ground. You expend its propellant and then you drop it and you carry on with, in this case, the ship, as they call it, the top part. Now, that all worked perfectly. Things went slightly awry after that. But up until that point, it was looking really, really good. So I think Elon Musk was looking at 60% success. I think he got 60% success today.
And so what happens next? Try again?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they've got a production line of these rockets in Boca Chica on the Mexico border with Texas. So they have, I don't know how many vehicles, but a few almost ready to go. So what you're going to see now is these launches coming thick and fast, pending permissions from various federal agencies that do all the licensing. And they need to get something of a move on as well. And there's a few reasons for that. One is Elon Musk really needs this rocket for his other businesses. You know, he's building an internet constellation in the skies. It's called Starlink with these satellites. There's thousands up there. The new satellites are bigger and heavier. He needs a bigger rocket. Starship is that rocket. Also, NASA, the US space agency, wants to use a version of this rocket to land people on the moon. It's going back to the moon, 50 years after Apollo 17, the last time we were there. They're going back later this decade, and they want to use Starship as the system that gets them down to the lunar surface. So there's a bit of a clock ticking, but they're stepping through it. That's the point. You know, you test early, you break it, as they quite often do with SpaceX, and then you learn and you come back and you do it better. And I think they've done that today.
Jonathan Amos, our science correspondent. The Sudanese army and the rival paramilitary RSF have accused each other of damaging a dam on the River Nile, 40 kilometres south of the capital Khartoum. There are fears it could cause major flooding. Here's our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton.
It's not clear who's responsible for the damage to the Jebel Aulia Dam, but it lies near a Sudanese Air Force base, which provides a strategic southern entrance to the capital. Both sides have claimed to have control of that base. This time last week, the army and the RSF blamed each other for blowing up the Shambat Bridge in Khartoum. Neither side seems worried about the impact such destruction has on the civilian population, whose suffering is getting worse. The UN estimates that more than 25 million Sudanese are in need of humanitarian assistance.
Richard Hamilton. Residents of the Indian capital, Delhi, often face toxic air pollution that may be knocking years off their lives. Much of the city of more than 30 million people has been blanketed with smog this month, with the air quality earning Delhi the dubious distinction of being the most polluted city in the world this week. Our South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain reports from Delhi.
Walking just near the India Gate, it's almost 7 a.m., To just give you a sense of what this toxic smog looks like, imagine you're waking up early morning near a lake and that kind of mist that you see. That's exactly what it looks like, but it's not water particles. It's actually really harmful, tiny particulates that get right into your lungs. It's dangerous for people to be outside for long periods of time. Now, here are some people that are out for their morning walks. Let me ask them some questions. Good morning, sir. You're not worried about the pollution?
There is no other way for us. Either we should sit in our house for next 2 months or so, because till the time winter is there, it will continue.
Often this time of year, pollution levels in Delhi get really high, and it's for a bunch of reasons. One, in neighboring states, you have farmers that are burning off their residual crop. That air comes and blankets over Delhi. It's also getting kind of cold, and so it traps the polluted air over the city, and there's very little wind to dissipate that pollution. What's made it worse in the last couple of days is the Diwali celebrations. People were celebrating the Hindu Festival of Lights using firecrackers, and that contributed quite significantly to the current pollution levels. So I'm at the Center for Science and Environment. It's a New Delhi-based think tank. And I'm here to speak with the executive director, Anumita Roy Chaudhary.
There are actually no short-term answers for sustained improvement in air quality. When you have this kind of smog episode, you take emergency action. All that you can do through emergency action is not to load more. Otherwise, for us to really clean up the air, you really need more sustained action at infrastructure and system level.
Some of the emergency action that's being put in place includes things like halting all construction projects and preventing diesel trucks from entering the city. But for some, it's real piecemeal solutions for a problem that affects absolutely everyone that lives in Delhi.
November is what was supposed to be like one of the best months. It used to be such lovely weather. And now it sucks. It's depressing, you know. And it's every year, year after year, it's the same thing.
But Roy Chaudhary remains hopeful because people at least are talking about the problem.
What is really interesting now in Delhi at least, that conversation around air pollution has really turned. I mean, today, air pollution is really a conversation in everyone's drawing room.
And that report from Delhi by our South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain. It's been doling out advice for more than 250 years, but now the Etiquette Guide de Bretz has set out the correct way to use mobile phones. It lists 10 rules to follow when making a call, including advice to send a text first. Greg McKenzie has the details.
De Bretz Etiquette is an unrivaled guide to protocol and modern manners, offering information about addressing royalty, people with titles, as well as advice on correspondence, rites of passage, business etiquette, and also international etiquette. They've now issued their 10 commandments of mobile etiquette, which also warns people from having loud phone calls in public. The first rule reads, it's increasingly the norm to text before you call and ask the recipient if they're free to answer your call immediately or arrange a time to speak. Secondly, the guide suggests to never expect an unannounced social call to be answered unless you're calling someone from an older generation. Business calls are a different matter and are likely to be answered with much more willingness. But if you do call and don't get an answer, don't call again, De Bretz says. The 10 commandments of phone etiquette, according to De Bretz, are 1. Text before calling. 2. If no answer, send a text. 3. Don't repeatedly call unless an emergency. 4. Don't leave a voicemail. 5. Be aware people may find unsolicited calls alarming. Other suggestions on the list include a warning that it's important to send condolences and or make a call. Now, ahead of the King's coronation earlier this year, the famed Etiquette Guidebook revised its guidance, putting particular emphasis on technology etiquette. The handbook, created in 1769, now has pages on the rules for texting, emojis, and bizarrely, how to announce your engagement on X, formerly Twitter.
Greg McKenzie. A young mother in New York City who died of ovarian cancer has helped raise enough money to pay off millions of dollars in other people's medical debts. Casey McIntyre started treatment for the disease in 2019 and has now died at home. Her fundraiser is going up every hour. David Lewis is following the story.
If you're reading this, I've passed away. That was Casey McIntyre's final post on social media, and the message went on. I loved each and every one of you with my whole heart, and I promise you I knew how deeply I was loved. To celebrate my life, I've arranged to buy up others' medical debt and then destroy the debt. The Mother of One's fundraising page has so far raised over $170,000, meaning thousands of people may be in line for financial help. The strategy is simple. For every penny her charity appeal raises, a non-profit organisation, RIP Medical, pays off a dollar of debt. That means more than $17 million in medical money owed has been erased, and that figure is continuing to rise. How is it possible? Well, RIP Medical buys bundles of debt worth millions for a fraction of the outstanding price. Medical debt is a major issue in the US. Nearly 70% of American adults say they've received hospital bills they can't afford. That means up to 100 million people struggle with doctor's bills, according to the health research organisation KFF. Miss McIntyre's husband, Andrew Rose Gregory, who's helped publicise the pledge drive, told our partner station CBS they spent some amazing times together despite the progress of her illness.
Fantastic summer where we were at the beach, we were at the river, we were fishing, we were playing with our daughter. Chemotherapy monthly or chemotherapy eventually weekly. You're doing rehab after surgery. She went through a lot.
The family have now announced that next month there will be a memorial service debt jubilee, combining a celebration of Casey's life and anonymously buying up and thereby cancelling other people's outstanding medical credit.
That report by David Lewis. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back at the same time tomorrow. This edition was mixed by Ethan Connolly Forster and produced by Alison Davis. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.